You are listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Check us out online at starlegacyfoundation.org. My guest for this episode is Keith Powell and his wife, Jill Knox Powell. Keith is an actor and writer known for his roles in 30 Rock, About a Boy, and My Name is David. Jill Knox is an artist who creates hand-drawn, hand-painted artwork for her company, The Young Rebel Studio. After 3 years of trying to get pregnant, Keith and Jill experienced the devastating stillbirth of their son, Grayson, in February of 2018. It happened at 39 weeks and 5 days into Jill's pregnancy. In March of this year, Keith and Jill welcomed their rainbow baby girl, Dolan, into this world. Now they are trying to navigate what so many people have experienced, parenting a living child while also honoring the memory of the child they lost. Keith and Jill recently flew to Minnesota from California to keynote the Star Legacy Foundation's 15th anniversary dinner. Well, thank you, Keith and Jill, for joining us on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Well, before we get into the real heart of the matter, let's just learn a little bit about each of you. Maybe Keith, starting with you, tell us where you grew up, where you went to school, your career up until now.
I grew up in a lot of places, actually. I was born in Philadelphia, and then we moved to Monterey, California when I was in elementary school, and then Newcastle, Delaware for middle and high school. And then I went to NYU for film, then for theater. Graduated from NYU, and I started my career as an actor pretty soon afterwards, thankfully, a knock on wood. And I've had a career as an actor and a director and a writer for 19 years now. And I lived in New York City for 15 of years of my career. That doesn't sound right. Well, maybe I've now been saying 19 years for longer than 19 years now that I think about it. But I lived in New York City for 15 years, and that's where I met Jill.
Hi, I'm Jill. I was born in New York City, and I grew up between New York and Connecticut. Where I went to school. I went to NYU for undergrad and Brown for grad school. I have a master's in fine arts in acting. Keith and I met doing a play that a mutual friend was directing, a friend from that I went to grad school with and he went to undergrad with. But now I have a career as a visual artist. I have my own business called the Young Rebel Studio, and I make housewares and paint stuff, and people buy them. Luckily for me.
Hey, where do you guys live currently?
Oh, we live in LA currently. We've been there for about 8 years.
Okay. So how old were the two of you when you met each other?
I was 26. Kind of naive.
I was 29.
I'm very old. A very old soul.
I always joke to people, even when I was like 16 years old, that I'm a 70-year-old man. and my bedtime is that of a 70-year-old man. I yell at kids to get off my lawn.
He tells our dog to stop running in the house.
Yeah.
So when you turn 70, you're finally going to feel comfortable
like,
in your own skin.
This is where I've always was meant to be.
And I'm just always curious about people's careers, how they land where they are. Keith, at what point in your life did you kind of decide that you wanted to go into theater and acting?
I think pretty young. My mother just thought it was a hobby, but I went to go and see really crazy complex movies at 11, 12 years old. I remember going to see JFK more than once in the theater when I was like 12. And so I always knew that I wanted to work in film and television. It was always a passion of mine. I didn't know what I wanted to do in film and television for a very long time. I went to NYU to direct And then fell into being an actor. While I was there, I've always, though, wanted to study to be an actor. It was just always there for me. It was always present. I think the turning point for me was when I was about 8. They shot Star Trek, one of the Star Trek movies, in Monterey, down the street from my house, and I just saw all the film crew out there at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and I think that was I think that's what hooked me.
Wow.
Yeah.
And Jill, at what point in your life did you get into the visual arts? Was that an all life thing for you?
Yeah, or
that...
I think for me, I always wanted to do something creative, and I wasn't necessarily sold on a specific avenue. I took singing lessons. I got kicked out of ballet. Whatever, that's a very long story. But I was always doing creative things. But I think my parents' influence really led me toward the visual art space because my dad was the chairman of the Studio Museum in Harlem for a long time. He's been on the board since before I was born. And my mom works with the Contemporary Art Museum of San Diego. She's on the board. They work with MoMA. I was exposed to visual art my whole life in a very deep way. So it's kind of shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that is the...
You painted your toilet.
I did. I painted my toilet leopard to match my sheets. My mom was really, unhappy. I was probably like old enough to go into the store and buy paint with money that I didn't have to ask for. They would have asked me what it was for, and I would have had to explain it. So I'm going to guess I was probably like, maybe I was like 14 and going to the mall, getting dropped off at the mall with my like $20, you know, that's what I chose to buy that day.
And not many people look at a toilet and say, I have to paint.
It has to be leopard. And I practiced like many different ways of creating the spot so that they looked the most natural. Because I had leopard sheets and I had leopard, which is so funny because I'm not super into animal print at all as an adult, but I had leopard sheets and I had leopard towels.
Yep.
And I just saw this big white thing and I'm like, this is screaming to be leopard.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. That's a great insight into who you are.
Man.
Well, let's talk about what we're here for. It's June 19th, 2019. It's the first day of the Stillbirth Summit for the Star Legacy Foundation, our signature event. You guys are graciously here to deliver the keynote address at tonight's 15th anniversary dinner for the Star Legacy Foundation. But let's talk about your pregnancy journey. I think so many people think that pregnancy is easy. It's a joyful experience. It's very, very commonly ends in tragedy. And getting pregnant is easy. And I think many people would disagree with that. And I know you guys are certainly part of that group. But could you just share kind of your pregnancy journey from the day you decided, let's try to deliver some children into this world?
Now it's... I think it's almost laughable, my headspace post our first attempt, because we had decided to start trying to have a family. Keith and I had been together for about 5 years at that point, married for one, I think. Mm-hmm. And I remember after our first attempt, I thought, well, damn, now I'm a mom. Because they always tell us, especially girls, it only takes once. You know, as a teenage girl, that's what you hear. It only takes once. All you need is that one time. And so in my mind, that was the case. I had been to a doctor who told me that I was 31. He told me I was as fertile as a 20-year-old and I'd be pregnant in 6 months. And so I took his word for it, and it wasn't so. It took us years. We tried for 2.5 years before we started fertility treatments. 2 years, I think, before we started fertility treatments. We did 5 months of Clomid. We did 3 rounds of IUI. And IVF was our last shot. And so we did IVF, and that's how I ended up pregnant with Grayson after 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Let's talk about your pregnancy with Grayson. What was that like? And I think many people know how that pregnancy ended, but if you could, if you wouldn't mind sharing that journey with us.
I threw up every day for 40 weeks. I got hiccups the day they implanted his embryo, and the hiccups never stopped. but it wasn't that complicated. I didn't have any preeclampsia. I had no gestational diabetes. I would say it was a fairly smooth pregnancy. Because I was 34 and delivering after 35, I was in the geriatric range,
which is a medical term.
Laughable in so many ways.
And not literal.
But yeah, when you're geriatric and high risk, the sheer volume of tests they run on you is maddening and comforting. We saw a prenatal cardiologist that did a full cardio workup. We did growth scans and movement tests and all kinds of things. And I also entered into a study with my hospital, Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, a pretty large research hospital, called Healthy Babies Before Birth. And I went in every couple of weeks, and they asked me tons of questions about my stress level and the kind of support I'm getting at home and all of these things that could trigger any kind of unhealthy results. I got ultrasounds every time. So the sheer volume of ultrasounds and tests that were done on me and Grayson were more than your average pregnancy for sure.
Way more. Yeah, and as the, in a way, you know, because I, as the husband, I'm more just the observer of the situation and of what's happening. There's very little I can do.
You brought treats. That's not nothing.
And in a way, the more tests that were done, the more confident we were that the pregnancy would be successful. And that starts playing tricks on you, and we became... we became confident that that the baby was thriving and healthy, because every time the baby was tested, he passed the tests with flying colors.
We also ran tests on all of our embryos I feel very lucky to have gotten a pretty significant number of embryos in my first round of IVF. So we ended up with 10, and we did PGS or PGD, I'm not sure, I can't remember which one, that tests the chromosomal normality of the embryos. So we went in with a very
healthy
embryo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
But I ultimately think that might have had something to do with Grayson's demise. Our embryo, it was the healthiest, and it was the fastest growing. He was a vigorous grower.
Yes, that's true. They were charting him to be to arrive before his due date because he grew so quickly and was a big baby.
Yeah.
And ultimately, he died because he outgrew my placenta's ability to oxygenate him. It's called delayed villus maturation. The thing about Cedars that I'm really grateful for is that they assume you will do an autopsy. They do it for free. They encourage you to do it. So for their
research,
you have
to tell them not to do it.
You have to ask them not to do it. And I don't know if that's customary. Obviously, I've now delivered two babies, both at Cedars, but I don't know if that's normal. But the doctor assured us that we would get no results. Hmm. He was positive that this was something that was a fluke. It just happens. There's nothing to know. And then when we got results, he was really surprised. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've learned since teaming up with or joining the Star Legacy Foundation's efforts is that stillbirth is the most under-researched medical event, and his absolute certainty that we would get no results just magnifies that.
Right.
Yeah, it's very interesting because we, at that hospital, it was February, it was the middle of February, and that hospital that year had already had a number of stillbirths. I don't remember the exact number.
I remember asking every single person that came into our room, had they seen this happen before? Because, you know, your whole life you want to be special, you want to be interesting, you want to be unique. And in that moment, I did not. I wanted to be common. I wanted to be normal, general.
Yeah.
I wanted this to be... I didn't want to be unique in any way. So I asked everyone.
I think it was like a dozen.
And
I think
since
they'd
November,
had...
they'd had nine.
Yeah.
Nine.
And you know, you have to remember that Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles is one of the highest birthing hospitals in the state of California. So there's a large number of people that come in there with babies or come in there pregnant. But it was still staggering to us just the amount of the statistics and how common stillbirth is. We did not anticipate how much of a community it is and how little it's talked about.
Well, also Cedars, I don't know if it's because it's LA, and I know that I've read many articles about babies and families and population growth and pregnancy fertility challenges. Women on the coast wait long, for whatever reason, tend to wait longer to have babies. So Cedars is it's like a factory for delivering babies. I think they say they deliver 20 plus babies a day.
Yeah.
But they also have a huge population of high risk pregnancies.
Right.
They deliver a lot of geriatric pregnancies and a lot of high risk pregnancies because of the nature of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably see more of this situation than other hospitals, but it was shocking how many they'd had in such a short amount of time.
Can we talk about, if you're comfortable with it, the moment you realized that Grayson's heart wasn't beating and he wasn't going to make it? How did you find that out, and how did you react in that moment?
I can only obviously talk about through my experience. Jill went to the doctor on Thursday as a normal checkup. The doctor said to her, the heartbeat was perfect and vigorous and active. And the next time that he saw her, it would be in the delivery room. And so Jill came home. I was at work that day. And she called me that evening as I was on my way home from work, saying, the doctor told me to tell him if there wasn't a lot of movement, and there hasn't been a lot of movement. And that was this. See, she had just had the ultrasound that morning.
Right.
And she said, should I be concerned? I said, I'm not in your body. I do not know. Do you want to meet at the hospital? You know, you want me to turn my car towards the hospital? And she said, no, I think that I might just be overreacting. I got home that night. She and we had a pleasant evening. The next morning, she said, she woke up and said, I just don't understand. I'm not feeling as much movement as I used to.
Can I just interject with this? So my doctor said, are you still feeling lots of movement from the baby? And I said, no. I said, a lot? What's a lot?
Right.
Because your first pregnancy, you know, you can count kicks and you can do all that. But when you're work, like I wasn't super conscious of, you know, I was having contractions. And it all started to feel like the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I had Braxton Hicks. I had regular contractions. I had terrible gas. And he was moving. It all started to feel like one swirl of activity. And so when my doctor said, "Are you still feeling the baby move a lot?" I said, "Not a huge amount." And he said, "Well, your baby's starting to drop. He's running out of space. You're not going to feel him as much as you were a week ago."
Which is actually became true for our second pregnancy as well. So that is absolutely true. And then we, he suggested to Jill that she drink some orange juice and sit on her side and wait for it.
Sorry, I just want to just
tell you. Tell the story then.
Okay, I just didn't want to. No, I'm just saying. I felt like I was talking a lot. I was trying to give you an opportunity. Yeah. Sorry.
This is a real couple's moment.
Yes, I just, I don't know. I'm very chatty and sometimes I can sort of bulldoze. So I was just trying to be polite, but I'm realizing that the timeline is, you know, I was more in it than he was. So on Friday morning, as soon as the office opened, I called the doctor and I said, "You know, you've asked me this question and it's bugging me. You asked me if the baby was moving a lot. I said no." He's like, "Yeah, that's typical." And I said, "But it's bothering me. I'm really not feeling him move that much." And he was like, "Well, drink some juice, something with a lot of sugar or caffeine. Lie down on your side. And if you don't feel the baby move and you're concerned, come in." But he didn't say it in a way that made me feel like it was an emergency. It was kind of casual. I'm kind of an alarmist. I think he was speaking to that side of me. Mm-hmm. And his lack of emergency took away my feeling of emergency.
Right.
And so I had some orange juice. I lie down on my side and I felt something. Now, whether or not it was a contraction or I can't say for sure. And part of me felt for a long time like I failed my son because I didn't go to the hospital right away. Part of me feels like, I didn't know what questions to ask. I didn't know what I was supposed to feel. And I felt like I was just overreacting. So instead of going to the doctor, we went to the movies. I thought I needed a distraction.
Sure.
Labor was such a terrifying idea at the time. And they don't paint it in the best light in TV and movies. So you think it's going to be the most horrible experience of your life. I was terrified. So we went to the movies as a distraction. And all through the movie, I kept thinking to myself, "Come on, kid, you got to move, 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 move." And we got out of the movies, and I couldn't shake it, but I felt like I was overthinking it. The next morning at probably like 4 a.m., I was just certain, I knew. Keith woke up, and I said, "This isn't good." And so we still, though, thought, "Oh, we're just overreacting, but let's go to the hospital just so we can stop thinking about it."
And I'm sorry, is this Friday, the day after your
appointment?
So now
this is Saturday. Now we're into Saturday.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. And Saturday morning, we went to the hospital. I didn't bring the bag that I packed. I threw on some clothes that were on the floor of my closet, thinking that we were going to go, we were going to come back home.
This is about 6 a.m.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we get to the hospital, and I called my doctor's office on the way, and they sent the on-call doctor to meet us. We'd never met him before. And they brought us into a room. I remember the first time I realized that this could be really serious and not just me, when the admin people at the hospital were trying to get me to sign paperwork, and the doctors were shoving me into a room. Mm. I thought, "Well, I can sign this paper. Like, what's the..." And they were like, "No, get her on the machine."
They tried to... they used two or maybe even three ultrasound machines to make sure. And then they said, "I'm sorry that we can't detect a heartbeat at this time." Before we talk about that moment, I think it's important to say, because for the past couple of years, Jill has been saying that she feels like there's a part of her that failed Grayson by not going to the doctor earlier. What we found out in the ultrasound was the event, which is Grayson dying, happened within the span of about a minute.
Yeah.
And the doctor told us it could have happened as she was walking out of the doctor after a perfect heartbeat.
Yeah.
It could have happened on her way to the car.
He said to me, even if you came in on Friday and we detected a heartbeat, he could have been dead by the time you got to the parking garage.
Yeah.
And so in a way, the fact that we went to the movies was kind of, it was kind of our last, the last thing we did together.
And that's the way that I kind of see it. I think that it was our last family outing together. And in a way it was, I feel like it was merciful that we were able to spend that time not entirely sure what was to come with Grayson, that we were able to enjoy that moment with just the three of us, blissfully unaware.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Keith, one thing you just said a minute ago really resonates with me, because it sounds like when me and my wife experienced our stillbirth, our heads went to the exact same spot, which is, oh my God, I hope my wife doesn't blame herself for this.
Yeah.
I don't want her to hate herself for the rest of her life.
Right.
Before I was able to think about anything else, I was thinking about, I was wanting to gather all of the facts.
Yeah.
So I could make sure my wife knew that this was not her fault and she did everything right and there's nothing she could have done to prevent that.
Absolutely.
What is that? Why do so many guys go in that direction?
I think it's a protective thing, and I think that it's absolute. Well, because a default for in people, man or woman, is to think that you have control over a particular situation, especially when it's something that's happening inside your body, that you have control over it. And I think that the husbands in this situation immediately understand quickly that even though it happened inside your body, there was no control. You had no control over it because the husband has had no control for the past 9 months.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And there is a sense of transferring the not control, that is good English, having that wisdom that you've come to have in the 9 months, make sure that your partner understands that
mm-hmm.
immediately. It's something that I think that I still do today with her, and I don't think it's will ever be a conversation that will go away. Just because, even now with our daughter, Jill physically carried her, and she physically carried Grayson. All I could do was sit and fret and worry,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And come to terms with my lack of control.
Mm-hmm.
But Jill actually physically brought both children into this world. And so therefore, in her mind, it's an extension of her.
Mm-hmm.
That baby is out there, and that baby is an extension of her. There's still a cord tied to them.
Yeah.
And so therefore, you think that if I eat differently, or if I exercise more, or if I call the doctor sooner,
right.
that cord becomes protected. And unfortunately, it's just not. And what I like to explain to Jill, and I don't know if I'm revealing too much by saying for a long time Jill blamed her body. What I keep explaining to her was it wasn't her body, it was her placenta,
mm-hmm.
and that placenta left with the son,
yeah.
and it wasn't Jill. Jill did everything correct. It was the placenta, and of course, divorcing yourself from the fact that something that you created which was the placenta, was what went wrong, is a hard thing.
Right.
But I think it's important to remember that it wasn't her, it was the placenta.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say, an interesting part of the journey was coming to terms with the fact that I didn't do anything wrong. So there's nothing I did. So I didn't blame myself, but I did blame my body as if it was an other. Like, I took my emotional self and my actions outside of this vessel.
Mm-hmm.
And I placed blame on the vessel for a long time, knowing immediately that we were going to try again as soon as I got the all clear. Came with a whole host of emotional turmoil, but the biggest challenge was caring for my body to make it healthy enough to carry another baby and hate it at the same time. That was, trying not to use vulgarity here, this is a family show.
No, it's not. Go ahead.
It was a true mind fuck. It was a true mind fuck to say, I love you, body. I care about you. I want to make you healthy and strong so that you can carry my next baby and also hate it.
Mm-hmm.
For what it did to my first baby.
Yeah.
That was really hard.
So let's talk about the next chapter, which is your next pregnancy. And how much later after the loss of Grayson did you guys decide you were ready to try again? And can you talk about, I know that pregnancy wasn't
a
cakewalk either.
I asked my doctor before I delivered Grayson when we could try again. We had tried so long to have a family. We had tried so hard in so many different ways, and I knew we had some embryos. And it wasn't that I was trying to move on from him. I just knew that, I mean, as soon as I delivered my daughter, I asked when we could do this again. I want a family. I want more than one child. This daughter that we have was in the frozen bank and was going to be here no matter what. She just came earlier than expected. And he said to me, you need to take some time to grieve. And I had never grieved anyone before. I had never experienced loss that wasn't anticipated in some way, whether it was age or illness. And so I didn't know what grief was. And my thought was like, sure. But after that, what is physically healthy? He said, 3 months you could do this. You could carry another baby. So then I called a shrink that I had seen off and on for a couple of years, and I said,
a therapist,
sorry, is that just for the record, I'm a child, I'm an artist child in a house of MBAs. Like, I was painting my toilet leopard to match my sheets. My dad has an MBA from Harvard. He was like, I love you, kid, but I'm not sure I know how to talk to you. So they put me in therapy when I was 6. So I feel like I don't know if that's like a derogatory term for therapists, but I have a great love for therapy.
Sure.
So just for the record, I love therapy and therapy loves
good
me.
Good disclaimer.
So I called a therapist and I said, from the hospital, and I said, my baby just died. I haven't delivered him yet. I need you to help me get right, so that I can do this again.
And because that was a box you needed to check? You needed to grieve before you could move on to the next pregnancy?
I don't think I knew what I needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was self-aware enough, I think, to know I didn't know.
Sure.
So I went to a therapist and I said, how do I do this? How do I exist now?
Sure.
I think of therapy as someone helping you gather tools for your toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that is, I needed tools to figure out how to grieve in the healthiest way possible. I was not going to stay in bed for 6 months. That's not me. I was not going to let my hair become dreadlocks and not shower. And I didn't want to take the Ativan that the hospital gave me. I wasn't interested in being a dependent on anxiety pills or not that I have any problem with that. I know that they can become habit forming,
mm-hmm.
and I know that this was going to be very hard, but I didn't want that kind of assistance. Mm-hmm. And my therapist said, your doctor said 3 months. I think we can get you there in 3 months.
What I think is important in that is, and this is something that Jill said to me in the middle of this process, I'm going to be grieving for the rest of my life.
Yes.
I might as well continue down a road in the middle of that and figure out how to navigate having to having a family with a member missing, because that'll always be the case. And so I think that the way forward was understanding and embracing that Grayson was never going to be lost to us, mm-hmm. and never going to be forgotten. But we have to move forward. And I think that that became, for me at least, a shining guidepost. So, the long answer to your question, it took us 5 months, because on the 3 month anniversary, or the 3 month anniversary of Grayson's birth, we called the fertility doctor and said we're ready to try again. And then 2 months later.
Right. Last thing about that 3 month box or whatever you mm-hmm. called it. I knew that there would always be a variable, right? Mm-hmm. If I gave myself longer time to grieve, whatever complications we had getting pregnant were just going to get more complicated. I was going to get older. I was going to get whatever the infertility, you know, because our infertility was unexplained. We were both in a good place. So they didn't understand why we couldn't get pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I thought, the longer I wait, the harder it will be going forward. Maybe not for our next kid, but maybe for our kid after that. Mm-hmm. And so I knew just logically, intellectually, that I didn't have 2 years to mourn my son. Singularly. So I was going to have to do this work forever. I might as well do it with a baby on my hip. Sure. And so what was the question about? At 3 months we called.
And then we started the fertility treatments for Dolan. And Jill was pregnant with Dolan mid-June?
July 11th.
July 11th.
They implanted her and we found out.
Yeah.
No.
Somewhere in mid-July.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And Dolan was born happy and healthy on March 9th.
One question I have for you guys is, we have something in common. We've both experienced the loss of a child unexpectedly, very deep into a pregnancy. But you guys had an added layer of Keith being a celebrity, that this became in People Magazine and other things like that. What was it like having the additional layer of, oh shit, the whole world's going to know about this. How are we going to share this with the world? What do we do with that piece of this? Because we live in a society where pregnancy is a joyful, hopeful, happy experience. Mm-hmm. And anyone who changes that narrative, it's like, whoa, what do we do with that information? Did that enter your heads at all?
After I delivered Grayson, Keith wrote a beautiful tribute to him that we sent out to our 300 closest friends and family. I mean, there were a lot of people anticipating this baby, and I had shared my pregnancy very candidly on Instagram, and I have a public Instagram. So a lot of people that I don't know followed because of that. A lot of people that I don't know follow me because of my husband's career. So there were already a lot of strangers in our home with us. Once he died, I posted a Instagram thing saying, thank you all for going on this journey with me. I'm so sorry to tell you that we lost him. So there was, people had already been following the journey. Then afterwards, I found myself having a really hard time on Sunday mornings, because Sunday was the day that I delivered. Mm. And every Sunday for a year, I wrote about him. And I counted Sundays. And I started every post with 7 Sundays, 52 Sundays, every Sunday. And I mean, the sheer volume of people that came to offer support, to share their story with me. They would read my Instagram posts and message me privately. Was staggering and beautiful. People from all over the world. A woman from England wrote me at 3 o'clock in the morning because it was 9 a.m. her time, I think.
Something like that.
And told me about 2 of her sons. She had 2 in a row that were stillborn, and told me their names and her journey. And by the time it had first appeared in the Daily Mail, I'm not going to say anything about the Daily Mail, but I have feelings. They posted something in October because it was Infant Loss and Awareness Month, and I posted the outfit that we chose to bury Grayson in, and that's the story that ran first. So between February and October, I had already shared a great deal of feelings and such about the loss.
Mm-hmm.
It felt a little crappy that they didn't give us a heads up. And frankly, I would have been very open to the idea. I can't speak for Keith, of sitting down and having a conversation and bringing awareness on a grander level than just them copying and pasting my Instagram posts onto their website.
Mm-hmm.
So that felt a little shitty that they just screen grabbed and ran a story,
mm-hmm.
when I think it would have been beneficial for all parties if they just called and asked, can we talk?
Right. We talked about this before we started recording, but over the 15 years that this organization has been around, Lindsay and her family, every time a well-known actor, a athlete, musician, anyone really, a public figure, politician, experience a stillbirth or a pregnancy loss. There have been dozens and dozens over the years. Lindsay has Googled them, found an email address, and reached out to them and offered the resources of the Star Legacy Foundation, offered her condolences, and said, let me know if there's anything you need from us. And none of those emails have turned into anything of substance until Keith, you responded to Lindsay's email earlier this year when she reached out to you. That makes you guys very special. We really appreciate you guys being here and sharing your story with us. But I'm curious, what inspired you to respond to Lindsay? It's very easy to ignore an email and just press delete and say, move on with your life. But for some reason, something called you, to which we are extraordinarily grateful, but something spoke to you to respond to her and say, how can we help?
When Jill and I got married, the New York Times wrote a piece on us. And it explained that, basically, in my mind, it encapsulated the reasons why we found each other and got married. When I found Jill, I was pretty closed off and not very forthcoming or revealing of any information about me to the world, because being on 30 Rock became a social liability, just because I was not able to go places and people were misreading my behavior negatively, and I was just not understood. Mm-hmm. When I met Jill, because she was in therapy since she was 7, what attracted me to her was how open and honest and loving and how much she wore her heart on her sleeve. And that was dangerous for me, highly dangerous for me, but also very clearly something that I needed in my life and needed to have in my life because I was becoming so closed off. So that was the reason why I married her. And we explained it all to the New York Times, and it was dangerous for me because it revealed parts about me that I was not previously willing to share with the world.
The title was Shy and Logical Guy Finds His Open and Wild Match.
Which I don't know if that is accurate for who we are.
I don't think I'm wild, but you know.
It gives you a contrast.
Right, right.
I say all that to say that my journey in being married to Jill has been a journey of tearing down brick by brick the walls that I have built up around me. Hmm. And even when it doesn't feel safe, even when it scares me. And so when Grayson died, it was important to me to not retreat. It was important for me to go forward and share our feelings about it in ways that could help other people. When Dolan was born, I tweeted something that said, you know, after 5 years of trying and the loss of our sweet stillborn son, we welcome Dolan into the world. That tweet became a massively retweeted thing, and that's when USA Today and People Magazine and the Daily Mail, picked up on that story. And it was in a way that tweet kind of got out of hand, but I had been on a 7-year, 8-year journey. Jill and I have been together for 10 years. On a 10-year journey of opening myself up and letting whatever happen. And so when the Star Legacy Foundation reached out to me, I saw that as an extension of a journey of sharing openly my experiences so that others could benefit. And that's why we came here, and that's why we carved out time in our schedule and tried to figure out how to help you guys in as many ways as possible, because getting the word out, the reason why so many stillbirths happen is because of silence. Mm-hmm. And stillbirth in many, many cases can be preventable by being open and honest and talking and having people hear you. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that is to be open and honest and talk. So I feel like what my life's journey is making sure that I share myself as much as possible, so that other people can learn and not have to go through the pains that we went through. And the person who taught me that is the woman that I married.
Keith, you really do have the wisdom of a 70-year-old man. Oh. Thank you for sharing that.
And the back. Really bad back.
I have a really bad back. Yeah.
Final piece. By the time this podcast is posted, your speech tonight will have already happened. Is there anything else that you plan to say in your speech tonight that you wanted to share with us, or anything we haven't yet said that you think is important to share?
Yes. I think that it's really easy when you experience tragedy or trauma to disappear. And disappearing, going under the covers, not letting any light in, feels really cozy. Mm-hmm. It's really scary to show up and face your tragedy. But that's the only choice. Mm-hmm. If you want to move forward and have a healthy, happy life, honoring your child, whatever whoever you were before, whatever expectations you had before this trauma and tragedy happened, not disappearing is really the only way to live.
Mm-hmm.
And that you are so much stronger. I think this is true for everyone. You're so much stronger than even you think you are. Bob Marley said it best. I love this quote, and I should just pretend that I said it, but he said it. You never know how strong you are until being strong is your only choice.
Hmm.
And I think that, and you won't be able to see my hands, but this is the only way I know how to say this. You know, if you ask someone how strong they think they are and they give you a level or a degree, they're really 10 times stronger than that. And I hope no one ever has to be challenged to find that ceiling.
Hmm.
But the ceiling is much higher than you think.
Beautiful. Well, thank you both for spending time with me to be on this podcast. It's really been a joy for me to speak with both of you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
That's all for this episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. I'm Chris Duffy. Thanks for listening.